Everywhere you go, it seems that there's a sale. Somebody has some kind of sale. Might be a grand opening sale, might be going out of business, might be back to school sale, which usually happens about 3 days after school lets out. We're coming up on Labor Day, so they'll probably start putting Christmas stuff up, right? Always have sales. And what's the favorite rack in the store now? The clearance rack, right? Things are really discounted. We were at a store the other day. They had name brand t-shirts of all different colors, you know, the nice t-shirts with pockets. $1. Why would you sell these things cheap? Two reasons. One, you want to get it. But secondly, there's so much competition. So many stores are competing against each other for the business of the American customer that they need to provide a compelling reason to get them in the doors. The bottom line is numbers. The customers coming in, which translates into dollars being made. Now, unfortunately, I think this same kind of sale mentality has crept into the church. And again, for some of the same reasons, because there are so many churches competing, which I don't like that idea, but it is a reality. Churches have a sense where they're competing for people to come in. They see people coming through the door as customers. And so they develop marketing schemes. We try to outdo the next church to get people in our doors because that means more people come in, and the more people come in, the more they put in the plate. It seems to be more of a business. But I wonder if that's really what Jesus had in mind when he established the church. Have we put salvation on sale? The late singer-songwriter Keith Green answers yes. He wrote, "Our gospel reduces the good news to a come-and-get-it-while-you-can sale. We make every effort to take the bones out, everything that might offend someone, might make him hesitate or put off his decision." A.W. Tozer agrees. He says, "Today's evangelist seeks to key into public interest by showing that Christianity makes no unpleasant demands. Rather, it offers the same thing the world does, only on a higher level." And we have been tempted in our day and age of mass marketing and salesmanship to slant the message to the direction of what's in vogue in order to make it acceptable to the public. The bottom line for many churches is like the secular business world numbers. The more people you have, the more spiritual it sounds. And I think preachers are as guilty as any of this. You get more than one preacher in a group, and immediately they're going to start asking, "Well, how many do you have in your church? How many do you have on Sunday morning?" It's a way of comparing. And in order to get more, the temptation is to cheapen the value of the gospel. To make our message, in the words of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, "grace sold on the market like a cheap jack's wares, thrown away at cut prices." I want to consider this from another perspective. Think of it this way. Imagine that your oldest daughter turns 25. She's not married. She'd really like to be. So you decide you're going to help make that happen. You take an ad out in the newspaper, put up a billboard, make up t-shirts begging someone to choose her. You may offer some attractive gifts as incentives. Doesn't that really cheapen who she is? Wouldn't it make you wonder if somebody was doing her a favor by coming and taking her away? You'd never do that, right? I mean, any parent that cared at all about his daughter, they would set the standards high. They wouldn't lower them. You do background checks, you know, lie detector tests. You'd have lengthy applications filled out in triplicate, right? You want to make sure that that person really loves your daughter. You want to make sure they give the very best for her. You don't want to just hear him say that he loves her. You want to see it. You want to know that he's committed to her. That he would even give her life for her. Now just translate that over to the message of the gospel. But too often, preachers try to talk people into following Jesus. To make it more appealing, maybe sweeten the deal. We don't want to say anything that might offend somebody. But we want to make it sound as easy and as comfortable as possible. And what you end up with is a discounted advertising of the gospel. But again, I ask, is that the gospel according to Jesus? Is that what he presented when he walked this earth? When he called men and women to follow him? The answer, you go back to the New Testament, is an emphatic no. The Gospels are clear that Jesus never lowered his standards. He never cheapened his message to get people to follow. If anything, he did just the opposite. Salvation was never on sale with Jesus. He plainly taught that discipleship had a high cost. That passage that was read earlier from Luke chapter 14. You don't think this got people's attention? If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he can't be my disciple. Whoa, wait a minute. Time out, Jesus. You really trying to get somebody to follow you here? You're throwing that word hate around. People are uncomfortable with that word hate. And you're saying, you're supposed to hate your father and mother? Wait a minute, what about the commandment that says honor your father and mother? You turning that around? What are you saying here? And then he goes on, if anyone does not carry his cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. Now, see, the cross to us is a decoration. And we think of it as a badge of honor. You know, people wear a cross on a necklace or maybe a lapel pin. We put a cross on our bumper stickers or we decorate our houses with them. Trust me, nobody did that in the first century. It would be somewhat similar, even though this is a bit antiquated now, but it would be somewhat similar to wearing an electric chair around your neck. See, back then the cross meant only one thing. It was a condemned criminal going to die. And it was a brutal, gruesome, agonizing death, as well as humiliating. You wouldn't wish crucifixion on your worst enemy. And Jesus says, unless you take up your cross and follow me, you can't be my disciple. That doesn't sound easy to me. That doesn't sound comfortable. And it doesn't sound like the message that is often presented today. Jesus said, there is a cost. And he goes on in that passage to tell his people, count the cost. He says, suppose one of you is going to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost and make sure you have enough money? If you don't, you'll get it halfway done and have to quit because you'll run out of money. And then people are going to make fun of you. Did that actually happen? In my hometown, and some of you might have heard of this guy. He was one of these faith healer TV evangelists, Ernest Angley. Maybe some of you heard Robin Williams do a spoof on him called Ernest Angry. Little guy with no neck and say friends. He was almost a comic book character, but he was real. And he had a whole bunch of people follow him. And he literally was going to build a tower there in Akron, Ohio. And he's going to have a big old restaurant at the top and, you know, and bring people to Jesus. You know, it was his idea. he ran out of money. He got the shell of it up, and that was as far as it went. And he was a laughingstock of that whole area. It's exactly what Jesus said. It's amazing to me that a preacher of the gospel wouldn't have at least read that story and said, maybe this applies here. Or he uses the example of a king going out with his army to battle. And if you're facing an army of 20,000 and you've only got 2,000, unless your name's Gideon, I think I would be sending an emissary saying, can we talk about this? Count the cost. Think about it. Don't come to Jesus because we're playing 87 verses of Just As I Am and you feel guilty. Think it through, because it's going to cost you everything. So the lesson is plain. Jesus does not want followers to rush into discipleship without thinking about what's involved. And he's very clear about the cost of discipleship. It's going to cost you everything. Now, that's not the end. Because while it costs you everything, you're going to get back even more. And that doesn't mean in dollars and cents or a bigger house or a nicer car. You're going to get more of what's really important. But the cost is everything. Now, this wasn't a popular message. If you go through the Gospels and count how many people followed Jesus as opposed to how many people turned away from Jesus, which number do you think was bigger? The people that turned away. By a lot. He would get these big crowds that would follow him because he would perform a miracle. You know, feed 5,000 with a little bag lunch. Wow, this is great. People are all around him. And then he'd say something like, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you. And people are like, oh, this guy's nuts. And they'd walk away. See, he wasn't interested in attracting big crowds. He wanted devoted disciples. He wanted committed Christians. Now, he's not discouraging discipleship. What he's doing is warning against an ill-considered, faint-hearted attachment so that men might know the real thing. And what is the real thing? True discipleship means that we give our first loyalty to Jesus Christ to be nothing less than wholeheartedly devoted to him. And that's what that phrase means, to carry your cross and follow him. See, Jesus didn't say you must carry my cross. Jesus was the only one that could give the sacrifice that he gave. But he did say you carry your cross. And we need to understand it the way the people in the first century would have understood it. They weren't talking about a long list of burdensome troubles. You know, sometimes we think of, you know, a chronic health issue. Oh, that's an awful big cross to bear. That wasn't what he's talking about. He's talking about putting to death our own selfish ways. What the Apostle Paul would call the old man. The sinful person that wants what they want, and that's all that they want. When Jesus called a man, he bids him to come and die. Die to your old self. Die to your old ways of thinking and living. But the good news is, Jesus didn't stay dead, and neither do we. We are raised to new life. And that life is so much better than the life that we left behind. Now, such a price is deemed too high by many. Even for Christians, sometimes this commitment is something we put up with. But I like how Dietrich Bonhoeffer puts it. If our Christianity has ceased to be serious about discipleship, if we have watered down the gospel into emotional uplift, which makes no costly demands, and which fails to distinguish between a natural and a Christian experience, then we cannot help but regard the cross as an ordinary, everyday calamity, one of the trials and tribulations of life. That's not what the cross is about. The cross is saying, Lord, I cease to be the master of my own soul. I'm putting that man to death. You are the master of my soul. I am completely committing myself to you. So how do we understand the practical meaning of this statement? Another passage that uses similar terminology is still in Luke, back in chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, verse 23, I think this verse helps us to comprehend an important element of discipleship. Jesus said to them all, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me." Now, in Luke's version of this message, Matthew has a similar one in Matthew chapter 10, but he uses the word daily. Every day, the Christian is called to die. Every day, he renounces the right of his own sovereignty and will. Every day, we renew this unconditional surrender to Jesus Christ. You see, there is nothing self-indulgent about being a Christian. The opposite of Christian is not atheist. The opposite of Christian is selfish. Jesus calls us every day to that commitment. Now, the good news is you're going to have days where we kind of fall short of that goal. We have days where that old selfish nature seems to rise up and get the better of us. The good news is each new day is a new beginning. Each new day is a new start. And each new day we can recommit ourselves to Him. Doesn't mean we get saved all over again. That's not necessary. But we get a fresh start every day. Lamentations tells us that God's mercies are new every morning. Each new day gives us a new start. Now, returning to that original text in Luke 14, Jesus makes the statement that if anyone comes to me and doesn't hate his father and mother, his wife and children, and all that, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And people really get hung up on that word hate. We discussed this in Sunday school just an hour ago. Is Jesus saying that we hate our own family? No. He is saying that He demands priority over everybody else, even those closest to our own hearts. Think about what Abraham was told to do. Take your son Isaac and sacrifice him. That's an act of hatred, wouldn't you say? For a father to stick a knife into the heart of his own son, he'd have to hate him. Now, did God actually have Abraham do that? No, but He called him to that kind of a commitment. He said, "I want to know that your allegiance to me exceeds everybody else. That there is nothing and no one in your life that comes before me." That's what Jesus is saying. He's not advocating that we hate, but He is saying that we must be willing to sacrifice anything and everything to Him. Think about it. If the Lord went to the cross for us, the least we can do is to carry our cross for Him. Now, I know such thoughts sound uncomfortable, but they can be tolerated as long as they're not too specific. But you look at the life and ministry of Jesus, and He would get painfully specific about those things that must be sacrificed in order to be His disciple. The cost of discipleship in those days included comfortable and lucrative occupations. Jesus called Simon and Andrew and James and John away from their fishing boats. He called Matthew from the tax collector's booth. And trust me, he was making a lot of money. Not honestly, but he was making it. Zacchaeus had built a fortune. But He said, "You come and follow Me." To the rich young ruler we saw last week, He said, "Go sell your possessions and follow Me." Now, He doesn't expect that of everybody. But don't get too comfortable. He will not allow possessions to get in the way of our allegiance to Him. And beyond material possessions, Jesus calls His disciples to sacrifice themselves. You think about those early disciples. Every one of them was subjected to ridicule, torture, and all but one of the original 12 died a violent death because of their faith. And I'm not saying the same thing is going to happen to us, but we may lose friends. It may damage our reputation when people know we're a Christian. It might cost you at work. It might cost you a promotion. You might be too honest to get that promotion. You might have too much morals for whatever particular business you might be in. You willing to make that sacrifice for the cause of Christ? See, this is the cost of discipleship, and salvation is never on sale. I'd like to close this morning with an illustration from an Old Testament text. I know the books of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, they sound like dry, dusty history. But there's lessons that we can learn. And I'd like you to turn to 1 Kings chapter 20. 1 Kings chapter 20. In your Old Testament, the books go Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel, and then the Kings. If you get to Chronicles, you've gone too far, you've got to go back. 1 Kings chapter 20. Now I'd like to begin reading in verse 1. Now Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, which would now be considered Syria, mustered his entire army, accompanied by 32 kings with their horses and chariots. He went up and besieged Samaria and attacked it. This is the northern kingdom of Israel's capital city. He sent messengers into the city to Ahab, king of Israel, saying, "This is what Ben-Hadad says, your silver and gold are mine. The best of your wives and children are mine." And the king of Israel answered, "Just as you say, my lord the king, I and all I have are yours." What did Ahab give at this point in time? Unconditional surrender. Some of you might remember from American history, the final general of the Union armies, U.S. Grant. Now, his full name was Ulysses Simpson Grant. I understand why he went by his initials now. Back in those days that the U.S. stood for unconditional surrender, because that's the only way he would fight. The only way he would call off his troops is unconditional surrender. And that is what Jesus calls for His disciples. Unconditional surrender. We don't go to Jesus and say, "I'll follow you, but..." "I'll follow you if..." No, no conditions. Jesus says, "I want you, and I want all of you." We had read from Luke chapter 9, you go further in that chapter. Someone comes and says, "Lord, I want to follow you, but..." He went to another man, "You follow me. Okay, but first let me do..." All these people had come, they would come with, "Oh, I'll follow you, Lord, but..." "Lord, when?" "I'll follow you if..." They're putting conditions. One preacher was preaching that sermon, and all the people were saying, "Lord, I'll follow you, but I need this, or but I need to do that." And he said, "We need to put our butts on the altar." I don't think that was quite how he meant to say it, but Jesus will not allow, though, conditions. We cannot negotiate. We can't bring down the price. The cost of discipleship is all. Just like in that hymn before communion. Jesus paid it all. All to Him I owe. Not some. Not whatever I have left over. Not if I feel like it. All to Him. Now, does that mean that we end up with nothing? No. We saw last week, Peter went to Jesus and said, hey, we've left everything to follow you. And Jesus said, trust me, you're going to get so much more in return. It is so much better, not just in heaven, in this life as well. It is the best life possible. Doesn't mean it's easy. It's not always going to be comfortable, but it is always going to be the best. Today we wrap up the Olympic Games. A number of you have been following them, televised over from London. Do you see the joy that those athletes get when they win that gold medal? Even those that maybe win the silver and bronze, they're so excited. They're pleased with what they did. They're happy with what they did. Do you think it was easy getting that gold medal? Talk to any of them. You know it's not easy. They sacrificed sleep. They sacrificed junk food. They sacrificed all kinds of things in order to get that gold medal. And you ask any one of them and say, was it worth it? I guarantee you they say yes. Absolutely worth it all. Was there a cost? You bet there's a cost. Was it worth it? You bet. Jesus says, come follow me. Now there's a cost. And he's not hiding it. We sometimes try to hide it. We'll say things like, oh, just come to Jesus and all your problems will go away. No, not really. Your problems don't go away. You're just able to handle them better. You just come one hour a week. That's all Jesus requires. Really? It's not what it says in the Bible. He wants all of you. And unless we're prepared to give Him all, we're going to be very disappointed, and so is He. I think some of the most miserable, frustrated people are those who think they can go halfway with Jesus. Because they know what they ought to be, and they know they're not. They know what the Christian life ought to be, and it ain't. And if you ask people who don't go to church why they don't go to church, one of the number one answers you're going to hear is, oh, the hypocrites in church. Sometimes they're right. So many churches, so many preachers have tried to broaden the narrow gate. We tried to say, come and get it while you can. We tried to make it too easy. We've cheapened the grace of God. And most people, when they see something is cheap, they don't have much respect for it. When something costs, you know it's valuable. Are we prepared to follow Jesus, whatever the cost? Are we prepared to give Him that unconditional surrender? There's no room for half-heartedness. No such thing as a partial commitment. You can't be sort of committed. You either are or you're not. Those who are totally committed are counted as Jesus' disciples. Those who are not cannot claim Him as their Lord or Savior. Andrew Murray summarizes the desire of the true disciple. I want to use these words. My Lord, O King, according to your word, I am yours and all that I have. As the words of absolute surrender with which every child of God ought to yield himself to his Father. What about us? Are we willing to pay the price? Have we counted the cost? Or are we trying to sell Jesus at a discount price? Paul said, I'm determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Nowadays, so often it's Jesus Christ and what He can do for you. You cannot have any more exact opposite than the Bible's Christ-centered gospel and our modern crossless, me-centered gospel. And that is not the gospel we're preaching here at Texas Christian Church. We are echoing the call of Jesus, and He said, follow me. Take up your cross and follow me. We need to restore the reality of the gospel. We need to present salvation in its truest sense, price tag and all. And most importantly, we need to evidence the reality in our lives. Demonstrating a death to self that shows we're truly carrying our cross as we follow Him.